Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about, say it with me, the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is Episode L, Historia Augusta. Before we delve headlong into the story of Hadrian, we take a moment to look at our main source from here on out. And brace yourself, this is going to get messy. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The Historia Augusta is a series of biographies of emperors, a bit like the biographies that we've already had with Suetonius, but unfortunately not starting straight after Suetonius. It starts three emperors after Domitian with Hadrian, so starting in the early 2nd century, and goes up to the emperors in the late 3rd century. So it's covering just over 150 years of emperors. We do have a gap right in the middle of the 3rd century with four emperors missing. It's biographies that we don't know very much about the origin of. So we call it the Historia Augusta, the Augustan history. We can't give it an author's name because we don't know who the author was. The Historia Augusta, however, probably isn't what it was called in antiquity. The title's first used in the early 1600s. So it's a modern, relatively modern scholar who invented that name for this series of biographies. They're a very confusing body of texts, as we'll see.
Were they meant to be a body of texts, or are they just a bunch of extant texts that we've lumped together with the one descriptor?
No, they're found together. They're clearly meant to be together, at least as far back as we can go in the manuscript tradition. And it seems quite likely because there is actually a lot of similarity in terms of the style of writing. So it looks like they are one text.
You said that we don't know the name of the authors. Do we know anything about it, or are there any theories as to who could have written the texts?
Oh, so many theories.
Yeah, okay.
The texts themselves do state an author. You might think that simplifies it. But it actually makes it more complicated. The biographies weren't, on the face of it, all written by the same person. We have four main names and two others associated with them, so six authors. And they are Aelius Spartianus, Iulius Capitolinus, Volcarcius Gallicanus, and Aelius Lampridius are the main four, and then Trebellius Pollio, and my favourite, Flavius Vopiscus. So various biographies are stated to have been written by these people. It actually says it in the text.
So we're writing this anthology together. You take this chapter, I'll take this chapter, that kind of thing?
That's exactly how it seems to appear. It's an attempt by various different people to fill the gap that's left after Suetonius.
All right. So possibly a Nerva and a Trajan at some point that we've lost.
We know there was a Nerva and a Trajan at one point by Marius Maximus. And in fact, we think that the early biographies in the Historia Augusta collection are based on Maximius Maximus's work. We've lost Maximus, unfortunately. Now, the Historia Augusta has actually been the object of a lot of study and many changed views over the decades and the centuries. So scholars have determined since about 1880 that is probably just one author who's pretending to be six authors.
Okay, yeah.
Which is very, very strange. So apparently, from these apparent six scriptores of the Historia Augusta, six writers, scholars have determined that there is, in fact, just one writer, a scriptor, not scriptores. It was put forward as a theory by a man called Dessau in the late 19th century, and it is now accepted as fact.
Okay.
As close to fact as you can get. Mostly this is based on the fact that it's pretty clear from analyses that have been done that they're all written in exactly the same kind of style. And this has actually been backed up more recently. So you can get classicists looking through them and saying, I would say that's the work of one author. Very much as you might get art historians looking at paintings to identify something as genuine Leonardo da Vinci. However, recently this has been backed up by putting the texts through specially created computer programs, which have determined that, yes, it's very likely that there was one writer.
So when was it written? Do we have any idea about when it first came about?
Well, that has changed too.
Okay. Of course it has, yeah.
The texts themselves are dedicated to particular emperors. Some of them are dedicated to the Emperor Diocletian, who reigned in the late 3rd century and died in 305 CE. Some of them are dedicated to Constantine I, the emperor who famously introduced Christianity, whose early 4th century, died in 337. And some of them are dedicated to Constantine's father. So it looks like late 3rd, early 4th century.
And considering the period that it goes up to, that would be about right, wouldn't it?
Yes, indeed. Because it goes up to 284. They're starting to
just
write
just before
at that
Diocletian,
point.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. However, our views on this have evolved, and for a series of reasons, we now think that it was actually written almost a century later than that. So probably in the late 4th century, possibly early 5th century.
Okay. Can I guess that it's like they used this word and that word didn't exist then? They used this term, and that's really strange for that period of time. It wouldn't have come up until the 6th century. And so on.
You're quite right. It is about those kinds of things. A good example is the fact that one of the emperors who is called Maximius the Thracian, great name, Maximius Thrax, he's often called.
Wait, who else was Thracian? Was Spartacus Thracian?
Yes.
Okay.
Well done.
Keep going.
Maximius the Thracian is called in this biography a barbarian. He's literally called a barbarian of mixed Goth Alani ancestry. Now, he's from Thrace, which is northern Greece, we would think of it as. But in the period of the early 4th century, when this text was apparently written, this would be anachronistic to think of people in Thrace as Goth or Alani, because these northern peoples didn't arrive in Thrace until 375. So in the early 4th century, this wouldn't have been the case. So it doesn't work for the early 4th century.
Can I play devil's avocado? could that just be a term that's crept into subsequent rewritings by monks, you know, maybe trying to clarify what was meant in this account, so they've put that term in there and suddenly it's just part of the text?
I guess that's possible. I mean, it is very specifically said that he's a barbarian from this place. Mm. And if that was an isolated example, then you certainly could argue that. But there's a whole series of reasons why scholars think the 4th century is much, much more likely. One of which is that the text seems to depend on later sources. For example, a section in the life of Marcus Aurelius is clearly taken from Eutropius, who was writing in 369 CE.
Okay.
There are things that are mentioned that seem to be institutions that existed later. For example, it's mentioned that Constantine I, was ruled by eunuchs and later broke free. This would be a strange thing to write if you were actually dedicating certain of the biographies to Constantine.
Mm.
And it's also an institution that, to a certain extent, develops a bit later than it's been mentioned here, if it was written in the early 4th century. It also seems to know things that are going to happen in the future and suggest them as good things to do. So it tells Constantine in the dedication that, you know, it'd be a good idea to promote this particular person, which would seem to be something very presumptuous to do to an emperor.
If you were writing during that period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in fact, it was probably written much, much later, and Constantine had promoted that family. It's suggestions that are made actually in the full knowledge that this already happened, being wise with the benefit of hindsight. Oh, how clever you were, because you're actually talking about the past.
Why? I can't fathom why anybody would write like that.
Well, there are a few different ways of seeing it, that this person made mistakes, because we all write with our cultural assumptions, and they were pretending to write it earlier, but they didn't manage to carry that deceit out properly. Or there's a theory that this is an elaborate parlor game, that this person wants you to spot the mistakes, and if you're clever enough, you will, that it's a very playful text. There's also the idea that the reason for dedicating it to emperors from an earlier period, which only makes sense if they're alive to give you benefits, is that there are parallels between the emperors that this person is writing under and particular emperors in the past. There's one theory that the ones dedicated to Diocletian were written at a time where it seemed like one of the rulers of the Western Empire, because the empire is partially divided in this period, it looked like a man called Eugenius, a ruler in the Western Empire, would come to a kind of supreme power. So Diocletian is a kind of parallel for Eugenius, who was a pagan, but a very experienced general, as opposed to the ones dedicated to Constantine might have been written during the reign of Theodosius, who was very much a Christian emperor.
Yeah.
So would look back kindly to Constantine, who was the first emperor to embrace Christianity, but who clearly didn't want to base the emperorship upon experience alone. He was interested in founding a dynasty. So there are good parallels for them. And I quite like that theory that they're actually harking back. They're saying, well, I dedicate this to Diocletian because anyone who's important can see that I'm actually referring to this later emperor. But at the same time, let's just say that it all goes pear-shaped for Eugenius. Well, I haven't actually dedicated it to Eugenius. So you can't come around and say you were clearly on his side. We're going to get rid of you.
Okay, so it's hedging its bets that way.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, we can definitively say that it wasn't written after a certain date, can't we?
We can. That we can put the terminus antequem, it's called.
Nice.
The end point before which at 425. And that's because we know that it was used by an author in that year. It was used by Symmachus. So it's already available.
So that's one messy text that we've got.
It is. It's a fun text. Think of it in that way.
It doesn't sound like the best historical record, but we'll wade into that. So what does the text comprise of? It's not just emperors, we should say. There's also biographies of other notables in there, isn't there?
There are. There are the so-called usurpers, pretenders to the throne, as we might later call them. And some of them are made up. Apparently, there's one called Titus, who was supposed to have risen up against the famous Maximius the Thracian.
Mm.
This is in the earlier part of the 3rd century. And he's one of those called the 30 usurpers, called the 30 tyrants. Now, we're very suspicious of these 30 tyrants from the Historia Augusta, because they're probably invented. They seem to be too neat a parallel for the 30 tyrants of Athens who existed in the 5th century BCE. So it would be a little bit of a coincidence for them to have been 30.
So some of them would have existed, though.
Some of them did exist.
Padded the numbers.
He did indeed.
Okay. So what does it consist of? We've got a collection of materials here, don't we? We've got 150 alleged documents. Great word, alleged, including 68 letters, 60 speeches and proposals to the Senate, 20 senatorial decrees and acclamations. Virtually all of these are now considered to be fraudulent.
These are all part of the biographies, all right? So they particularly occur in the later biographies, which were created after the biographies we have from Marius Maximus. All right, so Marius Maximus continued Suetonius's work. Almost certainly he had a Nerva and a Trajan and a Hadrian and so on. For some reason, the Historia Augusta doesn't cover Nerva and Trajan, but it starts with Hadrian, and it still seems to be on reasonably reliable ground, probably because of the pre-existence of a biography.
Mm.
But later on, it doesn't have these biographies anymore. It's post-Marius, who, you know, probably had 12 of his own, is the theory, like Suetonius. And it just starts to make things up and to back them up with so-called documents, letters that were written and inscriptions, people's speeches, etc., political decrees from the Senate.
So this is like a J.R.R. Tolkien coming up with the Silmarillion. So
yeah.
you've got like a whole book of footnotes.
Yeah. They're not substantiated anywhere else, which you could say is bad luck, that we've just lost everything else, but it's a lot of bad luck. One of the real killer blows for it, I think, is that it plays on an amazing coincidence. So towards the end of the 3rd century in 275, there was a short-lived emperor called Tacitus, not to be confused with the writer Tacitus, obviously. Supposedly, his biography comes from an earlier biography written by someone called Suetonius Optatianus.
Not to be confused with the other Suetonius.
Well, definitely not, but thought to have been chosen that name because it's probably made up, because there was an earlier biographer called Suetonius. And scholars think it's very unlikely there were two of them. It's not a very common name. So for there to have been two Suetoniuses at all is fairly unusual, but might have happened. But two Suetoniuses who were biographers of emperors is just kind of beyond the bounds of plausibility. He's probably made up this source amongst all of the others that he made up. Another good example of this is slightly earlier emperor called Aurelian, who people may know of, actually, if you've been to Rome. The big walls around the edge of Rome are the Aurelian walls, built by Aurelian in the 3rd century. There's an anecdote in the life of Aurelian claiming that Aurelian wrote a journal, so he kept a diary every day. And this is being used as the source, which would be amazing if it were true. Mm. You've actually got the direct notes, daily journal of the emperor. But we're pretty sure that this journal didn't exist. If you read the very beginning of Aurelian's life, the tone of it, the style of it, just sounds like, it sounds like the beginning of a novel, where the biographer actually says, I was at this festival and I was chatting to this guy about how terrible it is that there's not a life of Aurelian in Latin. And he said, well, there is. Look, I've got it here in my jacket. What a surprise. He actually happened to have access to a life of Aurelian in Latin. It sounds like it's setting you up to say, this is invented, isn't it?
Yes.
So a lot of these biographies are some kind of elaborate gameplay. It actually has been called by some scholars or paralleled with the mockumentary. It might be that kind of mockumentary form that's designed to appeal to some people as, you know, you can spot what's wrong with it. And if you don't, then that says something about you.
So is there anything useful then in the Augustan histories? Because this sounds like a mess. You know, why are we even talking about this in a podcast that we pride ourselves on historical accuracy?
Well, I think it's quite a fun text, but it kind of gets more fun in the later period. So it's easy for me to find that fun because it's the period I tend not to study.
By fun, you mean stupidly inaccurate.
Yes, I do. Just,
okay,
I do.
Yes.
Playing around with the facts, making you look for where the inaccuracies might be. But remember, the Historia Augusta is the text that tells us about Hadrian's Wall. Okay, we know Hadrian's Wall's there because you'd bump
because
into
it.
And there are inscriptions. But what it tells us about that wall is it's minimal, but it's backed up by inscriptions. It was indeed built by Hadrian.
Yeah.
So they're not wrong. There is a lot of accurate information in those earlier biographies.
So there's no other text that, you know, Dio doesn't tell us about Hadrian's Wall, by the way. So all that we've got is from the Augustan histories.
And as I've said many times, Dio, covering this period, he covers it, but we've only got the summary. So the Historia Augusti are really invaluable. And even where you might think they're very biased, and I would say the life of Hadrian and the others are quite biased, they do tell us something about a particular attitude. It seems to represent a particular senatorial attitude. It's not always 100% easy to pin down. Seems to be quite anti-military. So emperors that are kind of in the thrall of the military will come in for a bashing. It's quite ethnocentric. So has a go at Hadrian for being sympathetic to Greece.
Yeah.
So it tells us something about certain attitudes as well as the information that it conveys that we might not get from anywhere else.
But as a historical text, it sounds like we shouldn't be using it or referring to it at all. You know, we put this in the Wikipedia camp of, you know, everything you read on there could not be true.
We have to be careful. We have to be judicious with our use of it.
We've got no idea who's written that Wikipedia post. It could be biased. It could be false. It could be made up.
Yeah, I mean, this
also applies to the Augustan histories.
This guy we call Scriptor. Some scholars call him Scriptor, which means writer.
That sounds like a He-Man villain.
It does, or it sounds like an anonymous writer, which is what it is. But then we should be careful with using even people like Suetonius.
Yeah.
He has his biases too. It's just we know a little bit about him. We don't know an awful lot, but we know a little bit. We know when he existed and some of the jobs that he had. So we feel a bit more secure about using him, I suppose.
So how has the Augustan histories been used then?
Well, because it covers a period for which our sources start to be a bit scattered, it has been used by later historians quite extensively.
Because it's the best that we've got.
It is, yeah. And of course, the great 18th century work on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire covers this period and beyond.
By Edward Gibbon.
It is the work by the multi-volumed work by Edward Gibbon. He seems to take it pretty much at face value.
But should we be taking it at face value? No, we shouldn't, should we?
I think we have to make the distinction between the ones that we think were based on Maximius and the ones that clearly weren't. One of the most important scholars of this text and this period, a man called Anthony Burley, thinks that Marius Maximus was used for all of the lives up to Septimius Severus, so they're more reliable. It's after this that it starts to go quite mad. And others have said it's probably accurate even to a slightly later than that. The first half of the life of Elagabalus is probably okay. And then it just slides downward. And actually, the life of Elagabalus does seem to divide into two, half of it which seems quite reasonable, and half of it where his behavior just becomes erratic and weird and it just seems incredibly sensationalist. It's the people drowning in rose petals that I most remember from it.
Ah.
So there's a famous painting of it. He invites them around to dinner and then he just has so many rose petals fall from the ceiling that they eventually drown in them, and he's on a platform higher up so they don't reach him. And, you know, rose is very, very, very expensive.
Yeah.
So they die in this extreme luxury.
So it's literally got this point where Fonzie puts on some skis and jumps a shark in the Augustan histories. This is just the Roman version of jumping the shark is drowning in roses. We'll use that as a thing. So how are we going to use this in Emperors of Rome then in the podcast?
Well, I think it's as good as we're going to get for the emperors of the second century CE, and it is useful. But we want to use it reasonably carefully. And if we can back up any of the historical facts from somewhere else, then that's all to the good. We can certainly use it to supplement Dio. And we do have some other sources becoming relevant to this period, but they're the two main ones. We need to recognize that it is actively hostile to certain emperors and take that into account, and that it does very generally seem to represent a senatorial view, so not necessarily sympathetic to the idea of having emperors even. And as long as we bear that in mind, I think you can use it judiciously.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can find all 50 and then some episodes on iTunes. If ever you should be leaving a review there, this is the time. Tell us how much you like the podcast or how you just wish they were longer. You can like this podcast on Facebook. You can follow myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome and a fair few after that, we're diving headlong into Hadrian. That sounds a bit weird. But before I go, and because it is episode L, thank you so much to all of you for listening. I have the greatest fun ever making this podcast, and I can put the blame and thanks for that at the feet of Rhiannon Evans and you, the public, for listening. I say it at the end of every episode, and I actually do mean it. You've been fantastic. Thanks for listening.